Hey guys, the Rising Coaches Podcast is brought to you by Connor Sports, the market leader in sports, athletic, and gym flooring. Connor Sports, where champions play. Thanks for listening to the Rising Coaches Podcast. This is Adam Gordon, and we are excited to have you listening. We have a great guest today, Melanie Balcom. Melanie was the head coach at Ashland University, Xavier, and Vanderbilt. Went to the NCAA tournament 15 out of 16 years. Has done an unbelievable job on the women's side. Is a tremendous coach and spoke at our conference earlier this summer, and everybody there was blown away by her presentation. Very inspirational and just a great speaker and great person. So we hope you enjoy, and if you do, we hope that you would please subscribe to our podcast.
Hey Melanie, how are you?
Good, Adam. How are you doing today?
I'm doing great. Thanks so much for being on the podcast. We really appreciate it.
You're welcome.
All right, let's get right into it. Obviously, you spoke at our Rising Coaches Conference not too long ago, and it didn't take long for me to realize that you are more than just one thing and can't be pigeonholed into one specific thing. But you do have a reputation for being a offensive mind and an offensive guru. Mm-hmm. How did you kind of gain that reputation and what kind of led to that passion on the offensive end?
Well, I think it's a combination of the influences that were early in my life, growing up in a coaching family, my father being a boys high school coach for 35 years, and then a volunteer assistant for Pete Carril for a couple years, just growing up in a home where my father was always breaking down tape, and you know, that's all we had to watch was the reel to reel. I mean, that's how far back it goes. And you know, those early influences at home, kind of growing up at a gym, going to clinics, playing pickup with the guys all the time, was probably the biggest thing that I had when I was an assistant coach for years and went all over. But then when it was time for me to be a head coach, I had so many different philosophies and things to create my own system.
So I'm trying to imagine you growing up. Did you have brothers and sisters?
Yes, I was the youngest. I have a sister that played tennis at Auburn and a brother that played baseball at Georgia Southern. And then I played basketball at Georgia Southern and then at the College of New Jersey, finished up back at home.
So I'm trying to picture, like, so instead of, like, Saturday morning cartoons, was your family watching game film with your dad?
Yes. we never watched cartoons. I'm watching movies with my children now, making up for lost times. We didn't watch a lot of TV if it wasn't sports. And basketball in particular, we didn't have a lot of time. Like, I went to every high school. We joke about it now, me and my sister. I went to every high school game my dad had. You know, home, away. I never went to my own high schools. We were at different high schools, but my brother played for my dad. So we it was just all about my dad and his coaching.
How old were you when he joined the staff at Princeton?
I was already an assistant at Niagara University. And I can remember when I had time to come home. That was my first coaching job, and it was 8 hours from home in Jersey. And I remember driving down and being left a ticket to come in and watch the games. Prior to that, my father knew an usher, and we would sneak in the games. and he used to go into the old gym and saw Bill Bradley and all that, but I was too young for that. But eventually, when he was on staff, an assistant coach would leave me tickets, and then I would stop in and see whatever I could as well.
Was your dad running a lot of that stuff with his high school team, a lot of the Princeton offense? And
yes, he attended practice quite a bit, and I do remember attending some practices at Pete Carril's. But you know, he had some tough language. You know, nowadays you don't get away with that as much. But my father didn't always want me at the practices, but I did go to some practices, and my dad used a lot of those offenses and played, you know, a slow down half court. A lot of his games were in the low numbers. There was no running, no, you know, all the two guard front stuff that Pete ran.
Did that have a huge impact on you? I mean, do you remember watching those practices and thinking that this was great? Was it boring? Was it too slow? What are some of the impressions it left on you?
I thought it was fun to watch because I thought the movement, and that's what I think is tough today for me to watch sometimes the NBA and things is before the Spurs and the Warriors started doing this stuff, the movement. I loved the ball moving side to side, bodies moving side to side, the backdoor cuts. To me, it was like a painting. It was like artwork. and it was supposed to look a certain way. And I loved watching that.
So the player movement, ball movement, is what it's all about. What made those? What ingredients did those teams need to have to be able to execute that at a certain level? High IQ, shooters all over the floor. What was important?
Well, spacing is very important, like you're saying. Shooters, they ran a lot of high post offense and low post offense, but really four guards. The stretch, they now call it a stretch four. But, you know, when I learned the game from my father and his Princeton stuff, and when it was all broken down to me, it was guard, shooting guard, small forward, center. So he just started the number stuff. And for a while that was confusing to me because I didn't grow up learning. We all of a sudden got to numbers. And I used to joke about when I was coaching, if I could just tell kids that we have a 1, 2, 3, 3, and 5, which is really what we did, then everybody would want to play that 4 spot. But once you told a kid that, hey, you're going to play a forward or a 4, and they didn't understand what I was running and how they were going to get the most threes because they couldn't, their advantage and where the defense couldn't play them was, and their mismatch was on the perimeter. And so I would break down film when recruits came to explain and show the offenses I was using for that stretch four.
I'm so glad you brought that up because we deal with that all the time. So I'm glad to know, first of all, we're not the only one. But what are some of the things that you know, how would you sell it to them other than breaking it down on film, maybe even before you get them on campus where you can show them film? How are you explaining that to them and selling them on that concept?
Well, I think the biggest thing we tried to do was say, hey, you know, we're going to run a four-guard offense. That's first of all what I would say. We're going to run a four-guard offense, and everybody else is going to run a 1-2-2. We run 4 out, 1 in, or 4 out and 1 high. So 5 out almost. And I would explain the spacing and the opportunities that even if they run the middle of the floor or the rim runner, the first thing we do is set a down screen in our offense when we reverse the ball. On the first ball reversal, how many offenses do you set a down screen for your 4 and 5 from a guard? I mean, those are the things I would try to explain. And then this was the line I used a lot. Now everybody's calling it positionless basketball. Is I would say, do you want to be a position or do you want to be a player? Players play.
Right.
You know, you want to be a position, you're going to sit behind these three people at the three. But you could be the best 4 on our team and play all the time. And I probably can't keep you off the court.
Right.
Those are the type of things. I try to hit them where, you know, playing time, getting shots. Let me tell you, but in their minds, Adam, the problem was on the defensive end. So I had to have an answer there. They don't want to guard. They're fine shooting threes and driving on a post that can't come out and guard them. But, and then the other piece of that is the dribble handoff, which I'm sure we're going to get to. But back in the day, now everybody's running DHOs, they call them, the dribble handoff. That was a big part of our offense. So not only did that person have to be able to pass high low, shoot, drive, you know, they had to have a guard face up, but they also had to be able to put the ball on the floor and throw backdoor cuts and handoffs off the dribble. So I think the positionless basketball thing is really growing right now. And I think that's one of the things I talked to them about was just being a player, not a position.
Yeah, and probably guys like Draymond Green make that easier and easier to sell.
Yeah.
But still defensively, like, did you do different things to try to appease them where they weren't having a bang in the post? Were you switching ball screens or trapping?
Yes. Well, we talked to them about too was we back then we had a matchup zone, and that was our really was our bread and butter defense, and it screwed with everybody's head because it took everybody else out of what they wanted to run, and they would stand around and couldn't figure out our matchup. So what I would tell them was, you know, defensively, we're going to hide you. I know you don't think that you're going to guard a post all day and you can't guard a post because you're shorter and all this stuff. I said, but you won't be doing that. We'll be in a matchup. And we did a lot of mismakes. So if we scored, they were rewarded to play a matchup. And if they missed, we played a lot of man-to-man, switching a lot of screens.
You sound like you were a blast to scout your teams. You're going to have to play against some five-out offense and play against the matchup zone. Great.
Well, and the other thing we did, to be honest with you, is we did junks. We did diamond and ones, and we did triangle and twos. In fact, one of the last SEC tournament we won and beat Dewana Garner and Auburn, who won the league by one overall. We beat them three times that year. They were number two seed. I mean, I remember as clear as day is. And I'm not surprised what Bonner's doing now in the WNBA, but we ran a triangle and two instead of the matchup. So when there was ever a team where they only had two real scorers or one, we would run a rotating diamond and then face guard that other kid, or we'd do a triangle and two and rotate that triangle around and face guard those other two players. Because I'm an offensive coach, I look at defense a little differently. I think a great offense can be a great defense if you stay in it long enough. So I was constantly switching things and try to take away their strength, take away their flow, take away their spacing, whatever it was that was their strength. My defense, I called it scout defense. My defense was to take those things away as much as possible.
So how did you juggle all that in practice? I mean, that's a lot to get to. How do you become good at some things and not kind of, you know, what is the phrase? Master of none,
yeah.
Jack of all trades. So how did you delegate your time?
I think that's one of the problems that I had down the stretch is I had a guy that I hired. He was like a brother to me, and he would watch practice every day and say, Coach, you're 80-20. You literally spend 80% of the time on offense. And well, yeah, so did Pete Curl. I mean, you gotta make it simple on defense. And basically, I would recruit offense. I would recruit skills over athleticism. And the more athletic, the better. But in the end, I would say if you know, defense isn't a skill. It's heart. It's hustle. It's unselfishness. I can teach you how to play defense. And we're going to teach defenses that are fun for everybody to play and be a part of. And basically the goal defensively was to keep them out of the paint and make them all jump shooters in the SEC. And then we usually led the league in defensive rebounding, to be honest with you, because we kept everybody in front of us. Even when we were in man, switching, whatever, the goal was to make everybody a jump shooter. And a lot of teams aren't going to beat you on jump shooting.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned the recruiting piece. And so obviously you recruited skill, you probably recruited high basketball IQ, maybe sacrificed a little athleticism. I'm curious, how important was height to you? Because we have a team in our league, Belmont, who is unbelievably skilled. They shoot it, high IQ. And yeah, they sacrifice athleticism a little bit, but God, those guys are tall.
Yeah.
And so
they
can pass over you. Was that a big deal to you or no?
Well, not as much. And it's funny you brought up Belmont. Being in Nashville, that's another one of my mentors that I don't talk about a lot. Skip Prosser was a mentor of mine from Xavier, and when he passed, I didn't feel like I really had a mentor. And so I went over and met with Rick Bird and went to many of his practices, and I just loved watching his shooters. They would practice at Vandy sometimes, and I would go to the practices, and that's how we met. And it's funny, his wife was a big fan of mine, and I met her at the dentist. So we had a really good relationship, and I think Rick is one of the best coaches, hand down, in the country. So with that being said, those are the type of kids that we brought in and that we would coach, but we didn't always have real, real big size. Because I did like the athleticism as much as I liked skill, character, heart, and all that stuff. But I always felt like if you had a big heart, you could make up for your lack of size. And I had a post player, Ashley Early, who she was 5'9.5", and she was second in the league in field goal percentage, and she couldn't even shoot from the high post. I mean, she was my low post player, and she was drafted into the WNBA in New York, and they tried to make her a three guard. And I said, they called me, and I said, but she's really a five. Alisa Clark, I don't know if you're watching the women's WNBA, but this year it's been fabulous. And Seattle has a girl named Alisa Clark. I didn't recruit her because I had so many small forwards that became centers because they could have some of the guard skill. And she didn't have a three-point shot. But she led the country in scoring at Middle Tennessee State. She first went to Belmont and then the Middle. And she used to work at camps. But she has heart, character, and now she grew her game to where she's the best defender, shoots threes, and is that stretch four for a national championship WNBA team.
How about that? How did you identify the heart and character piece? Just talking to them and being around them? Were there certain things you
looked for? Yeah, and I think, everybody asks, what would I do differently if I had those last couple of years back at Vandy? And I think recruiting is just the biggest thing. I was very direct in the recruiting piece. I would tell them up front, hey, it's hard here, and you got to go to class. You're actually a student before you're an athlete. That student-athlete thing matters here. We work around your classes. We don't work around practice. I was very direct in how hard they would have to work. I said, everybody's going to tell you, you're going to play. I would never tell them they would start or how many minutes they would play. I never promised them anything. And I was different, and I think down the stretch when we wanted to get to the Final Four, and we wanted to get past the Sweet 16 and make a run, I didn't ever change and say something that wasn't true, but I said less. So with texting and all those things, you don't get to know the kids as much. And now, I think on the women's side, it's become more like the men's where they have an entourage around them. They have their parents, the ones texting you back, and you don't even know it. And you don't really get to know the kid the way I was able to get to know the kid early on.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Those would probably be the biggest two factors. Yeah. I mean, I think about Dee Davis, one of the best point guards I ever recruited. I was at Xavier my last year. I had been watching her and offered her going into her senior year is when you usually offered them, which was way later. And I started recruiting her in eighth grade. And I went to her team came to our camps. I knew everybody around her, all her coaches. I knew her family. And then I got the Vanderbilt job, and I tried to bring her with me. And Gino started going after her. She had a great summer. She was playing in Ohio on the AU team. And he tried to steal her, and thank God she had an uncle in Nashville. And her mom said she's not going as far as Gino. And I got her. And she was one, again, drafted with Houston, one of the best point guards in the country that we won championships with. So, you do get lucky once in a while, but I knew what I was getting with Dee. I knew she could play through injuries. I knew what kind of kid she was. I knew everybody at her school, her teachers, her professors. I don't think the recruiting rules today really allow for that.
Right. Right. It makes it harder for sure. And I think, like you said,
yeah,
the texting and the social media, we go to, at least on the men's side, I'm sure it's the same on the women's, but you go to AAU events and schools see kids for the very first time go off in one game and bam, they offer them, and I get talent is really important, but you'd think you want to know something about the kid.
Yeah. Oh, this is the other thing. I never recruited rankings. And now everything's about the rankings. And, I didn't hit it off with one of my recruiting coordinators and made a change because she was just recruiting rankings and high numbers and, wanted us to look good, like we had our classes ranked. And I didn't look at any of that. And I think later on, that's when I started signing and was looking at those things, not even realizing it, just thinking, I've got to get more talent. When you start thinking that way, you start looking more at rankings. And it's easier to figure out rankings for a head coach to just pull up her phone on the road when she's bored, you know? And now you know that kind of stuff. And then all of a sudden you're signing. I was signing 4- and 5-star kids and had a much higher ranked classes. And those were not character kids or coachable kids that I thought I was getting because I didn't know. And, you know, I think I took a lot of pride in signing 3- and 4-star kids and developing them to be 5-star kids when they left. And so if I get that opportunity again, or when I get that opportunity again, that's what I want to go back to is put character at the top of the list, put coachability, and then go from there.
Okay, let's talk a little bit about we talked about your influences, but what was your offensive system like and how did it evolve?
Well, you know, I think I explained the Princeton piece pretty much and loved seeing that sharing of the ball, reverse balls, threes going in like crazy, and then isolating a post player. And I loved that. But then I went and got a job at Providence, and Bob Foley was the head coach, and Rick Pitino on the men's side had just left. So Bob ran a very, very up-tempo style like Rick. He pressed full court, three-quarter, man, zone, you named it. We had 5 different presses. We ran the whole time, and we led the country in scoring, averaged 97 points a game, number one ranking. And so I looked at that and was like, wow, how could I take those Princeton concepts? When we got to half court, we didn't really have an offense. It was 4 out, 1 in. We called it ice. We just ISO'd the post player. There wasn't enough movement. There wasn't enough screening. And then there wasn't enough cutting. So I decided to come up with a way. I called it fast to slow. Now I call it fast to flow because nobody wants to hear the word slow. Just like they don't want to hear stretch 4.
Right, right.
So I've changed it. Dawn called it fast to smart. So I like to go fast, push the ball, miss make. Just like you're always going attacking and you're always going to their throat. Always trying to get a quick layup, a quick 3. And then if you don't have that, you're running right into a motion offense. And I did a lot of things off makes and didn't only ran sets and only ran quick hitters in situations and on dead balls. And back then, I was shocked when after I left Xavier and I got to the SEC, you're talking every team was more athletic than us, and none of them were running off makes. They were just running off misses. Now, I know I had an influence, and I think Pat would admit to that if she were alive today, because all of a sudden, a couple years in, when we had some great games with them and we were beat, you know, at Xavier, we beat them in Elite Eight, and we ran on them. And they were bigger, stronger, faster. And so I think all of a sudden she developed into, hey, we're going to run on both too. And so then a lot of teams started changing to that. And if you watch Seattle last night, that's what the Seattle Storm, that's what they want it with. They're running off misses and makes. And so I think the other thing was I noticed that a lot of teams that ran, it was fast to faster. And they got out of control. And the ball didn't move side to side, so you didn't have to defend very long. So I want to make them be on their heels, then go side to side and make them make mistakes, make them guard for most of the shot clock, which isn't long. But I also never had a secondary break. I ran right into motion offenses, depending on what the key was or where the ball went. We knew what we were running. So that's the flow part.
Was it hard to get your team going from 100 miles an hour trying to score quick to now pulling back the reins and slowing down? How do you train that into them?
I think one of my other quotes is change pace to win the race. I think everybody yells pace, 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 faster, faster, faster. And I don't think you can shoot. See, shooting is one of my specialties. I love to coach shooting. And you can't shoot as well on the move as you can set. There's not a lot of women players. Taurasi probably being the biggest one that I, you know, Maya Moore, but Taurasi can shoot a jump shot from three. But we don't have dunks, so we need to be able to spread the floor to give the post player room to dribble, make dribble moves without the double coming so quickly, and we need to be able to make threes. And, you know, I think that what I taught all the time and drilled all the time was you sprint and then you stop and get your feet set. And we made threes like crazy, led the country in three-point field goal percentage several times and threes made and field goal percentage. We didn't just go fast and chuck up shots. We took really good shots on balance and set. And if we didn't have that shot, what I taught was unselfishness. Everybody doesn't get to shoot the ball, but everybody gets to touch the ball. And really, people want touches.
How important are the did you have a lot of back cuts and player movement as well as the ball movement?
Yeah. I was talking to an assistant coach that I mentor last night, and we talked about special situations and especially coming out after timeouts. One of the things I always did was use my back cuts after timeouts because I remember Gary Blair telling me I'm so good after timeouts and all that. Well, I think a lot of that is just getting a feel for the game. So most of the timeouts are called because you made a run or your team is down and you want to make a run. Everybody gets jacked up in that timeout and they overplay. They defend the knot. And on a timeout, you could set up your specific player to make that cut against your fastest cutter, your hardest cutter, or against somebody that can't deny the cut in your scouting report. And the other thing is I just find backdoor cuts a thing of beauty. So, like, we would literally if we had five offenses with a backdoor cut in it to read, we would drill that over and over and break that pass down from the guard, from the post, and I teach passing to a nauseam. And I think that's one of the things that is not taught today is passing.
Are you – okay, I want to get back to passing, but on the back cuts, are you cutting on a naked side for layups, and if it's not there, we're reversing it and going into the next action, or do you have somebody back cutting and then that corner kind of filling up where almost that cut creates space for the next guy?
We actually did more offside, would you call it, the side just to get the layup.
Mm-hmm.
And if they didn't get it, then they came through and would set a diagonal screen, and then we double screen. You know, all my offenses, you talked about actions. We call them concepts, same stuff. I like plays with multiple actions and concepts. And I like a lot of backdoor cuts, staggered, doubles, because then you can curl fade, come up. You can do so many things off those staggers, and as well as dribble handoffs and a down screen for the a small to big. And it wasn't a cross screen, it was a down screen. So that big would roll, would curl, would read the defense, and we would drill that over and over. They curl, they come down, they'd go back door, or they'd come up for a shot. If they didn't have a shot off that concept, go dribble handoff. Now, then sometimes we would do what a lot of people are doing today. It's not really a backdoor cut. It's a dive to the basket replace. And see, I really tried to score on my backdoor cuts. And I had three rules when you cut backdoor. You had to cut backdoor. You had to look for the ball. You had to cut hard. And you had to keep cutting. And you couldn't make a cut unless you did that.
Mm-hmm.
And so you had certain kids that, you know, really cut hard, and it didn't matter if they were being denied or not. If you taught, and then I taught the bounce pass 90% of the time, there might be one play where we threw it overhead with that high post on that weak side, and everybody else is on the other side of the court. But most of the time, we did a backdoor pass right off the dribble. When they'd be coming up for that handoff, if they were denied, that post would work on throwing that pass off the dribble. With left hand and right hand.
So you guys are drilling weak hand passing every day?
Yes. Oh, every day. Same
That's
with
great.
The guards. You throw it to the wing, the other guard's cutting across, if they don't have a pass into the, they don't feed the post and make all those cuts off the post, they would dribble, they would pass up to that guard. Well, that guard's not open. She's going to go backdoor. And Pete Carroll's rules always on the backdoor with the guard right off the dribble one hand. And I'm not a fan of letting kids throw one hand passes, and we didn't turn the ball over much, but there's certain passes that I would say, this is how you do it. This is when you do it. This is where you bounce it. All those things. The higher you count above the block. So when that guard, you're supposed to pass the backdoor pass right off the defender's butt. You don't lead them into the paint. So if a kid threw it in the paint, we just keep doing it until they could throw it on an angle so that it go right behind the butt of the defender. You catch it, and if the help came over, they had time to make a play and adjust, maybe gather themselves, shoot the pull up or dribble and throw the drift. But they always knew they weren't going to just get a charge because you sent it to the rim. Those type of things. I mean, I'm very, very detailed compared to most coaches, I think.
So I'm sure you loved seeing defenses pressure and get in, you know, passing lanes. But was ball pressure hard to deal with? I mean, is it hard to make those passes? I would imagine if somebody's really kind of climbed up underneath you.
Yeah, and I think that the teams we really struggled with were the ones that really denied us and didn't let us, have that space to pass. We did get to the backdoor cuts. The other thing is catching the ball. Like, most kids, when they cut backdoor, they just let it go through their body. And they're going full speed and the defender is bumping them. Like, we'd have our male practice players bump our kids, and then they would have to go after the ball with two hands and grab it. Like, those type of little things would make it work instead of just running a backdoor cut. Like, they're the things that make that offense work. And I think when the league got really physical, that's when I started. This is kind of back to what you asked earlier. The time we spent on things. I slowly spent more time on defense because the SEC became a very, very defense physical team. We didn't have the Candace Parkers anymore and the Sylvia Fowles and the Simone Augustus. We didn't have those skilled number one players in the country anymore. And it became very much a defensive hold, hug. So anytime a player of mine would go set a screen, she'd be held. Any kid coming off that screen would be held. And that everybody's goal against us was to take away the three-point shot, take away our flow, our timing in our offense. And then we would struggle because we didn't have those kids that could make a play one-on-one and create a shot for themselves. That was the next tier kid that was at the top 10 schools. And we were in the top 25 consistently. But to get into that top 10, you had to sign those kids.
Mm-hmm.
And those are the ones that I was never able to get at Vanderbilt.
You mentioned you love setting all kinds of different screens, staggers, doubles. What were some of your screening rules?
What shoulder? Like, on, I love like back screen. And what's funny is we talk about which shoulder to set the screen on, but the biggest thing was coming off those screens and stopping and sealing. So, like, a lot of teams now, even if they get a good screen, that person sprints to the block, and then they catch it, and they get hit in the back, and now they got to make a dribble move. We would meet each other, so we would screen on a certain shoulder, on a certain angle, a certain width. We'd talk all about that, and then you'd read it, and you'd either come off on top side or low side, depending on which way the defense went, and then you would stop and seal the defense. If they switch, you're sealing the guard. And if you seal that guard that stays down and bumps, now the shooter that pop that set the screen is open. And that was the whole philosophy. You know, you get somebody open, whether it's a cut or a screen, you get somebody open, then you get open. You get, you know, you do something for others, and tenfold it comes back to you.
I love that.
But I don't see a lot of teams coaching. They just cut off that. And that's how I could have 5'10 post players. We got known for a very good high low as well as backdoors and threes, but we also got known for, you know, the small forward. And they always did the the ceiling and the footwork ahead of time. I had a tremendous post coach, Vicky Pikett, who's the associate head coach now at Houston. And they did all the footwork early. And I really let her coach the post. And I did a lot of the coaching of the guards, especially the point guards.
Yeah, I love that concept of, you know, you hear all the time with post players, you know, don't just cut to open space, get the defender on your back. But it sounds like you were doing that even on down screens and all kinds of action, almost on the perimeter.
They had to read the screen. They couldn't just, well, I'm going to come up off the screen and look to shoot. If I'm not open, I'm going to. No, we break it down 3-on-3 every day to where they had to read that screen and take advantage of that defense. And so that defense, you know, you could get a lot of opportunities. And once they curled, which we had a big post player, Steph Holzer, and a great shooter, Christina Foggy, that, man, I just tell Steph, she would just curl. She'd just come, even if they didn't trail, she'd curl, open up into Foggy's person guarding her on the screener, and then Foggy would pop, and she'd be wide open for a three. You know, it was more effective than pin downs for a shooter because they were able to screen whoever was coming up just by opening up to the basketball. And I think that, you know, that's a lot of concepts we did, those little things that, you know, you talked about scouting. I had tons of assistant coaches come up and meet me and say, you're the toughest team to scout. I hate having your scout. And, well, that's the goal. You know, that was the biggest compliment I could get because they're like, we couldn't possibly scout everything that you're doing. And I'm like, but the kids are reading it, which is what makes it work. I see too many teams now just run through plays. They just run through plays. They don't set screens. They don't read the screen. They don't use the screen. They don't feel. You know, my post players did not have to shoot over people. They shot by people.
And coach,
they're going to shoot a very high percentage on the block.
And that is the reason why you were able to take 3-star kids and go to the Elite Eight and, you know, 15 NCAA tournaments because you guys harped on those details.
The women's side is a little different. On the women's side, there's not as many tall girls as there are guys. So, like, Belmont can get big guys that are skilled, maybe not quite as athletic. Maybe they have to work on their physique. But me, I would take an undersized, tough kid with a heart that's coachable over a big kid any day. I just would. I can do so much more with her. Because a lot of those big kids are soft. They're immature. You know, they've been taller than everybody else on the girls' side. They're not very physical. They get shoved around, and they, you know, a lot of them played basketball because the basketball coach or volleyball coach or dad talked them into playing. I want kids that love it. I call them ballers. The more ballers you can get that just want to play ball, like guys do, then you're going to be more successful.
So one place you guys had a ton of ballers was South Carolina. How was that transition, by the way?
That was awesome. That was a great transition. That's exactly. I told Don all the time, like, I had enough ballers in 14 years to win a national championship, but not in 4. You know, and so if it wasn't for graduation, you know, I have an incredible team. If I put down my top 8 players, I go against anybody right now. But that's not. Don had all ballers. You know, I had some kids that were there for academics. I had some kids were there because they were tall and their parents wanted to play or they were playing for their parents or whatever. I didn't have that many ballers. So when I had them, I just loved it. And Dawn had all ballers. She had good character kids with really good parents. You're talking Elena Coates and Asia Wilson and Alicia Gray and Kayla Davis. Those 4 kids, they're all pros and we won a national championship. All had 2 parents at all the games and came from a great family of core values.
So
can't
what
speak highly enough about those kids.
So what do you think drew them to South Carolina and more importantly to Dawn Staley? Like what is so special about her? Makes her so good.
Dawn's there's a couple things that I think really stand out about Dawn is and I asked her this, why is it work? And she said, well, they let me be myself. And I think Dawn is her authentic self. and she's at a place that allows her to be. So it's not just Dawn, it's the people that she surrounds herself with who are very loyal to Dawn and her purpose. And she has a tremendous why and purpose in life. And she's a tremendous leader, and she leads with authenticity as well as integrity. So she does it right, and then she has people that she has put around her that are former players at Temple and, you know, former players at South Carolina and coaches that have been with her for years that coached her in the pros. That inner circle that she has put around her are people that really want her to succeed. And then at the top, her leadership at South Carolina, the administration gets it. Their AD was won the World Series, what, 3 or 5 times. Great coach in Ray Tanner. And when you put those people, Charles Wydell, he played football in the pros and played at North Carolina. That's who she reports to. These people that she reports to also have her back, and they let her be her. And I think a lot of that has been lost the last couple of years on the women's side, especially. And so she's the right person at the right school. She's the fit for there, and chose not to go anywhere else because of that. And I have a lot of admiration for that.
What was your role on that team and the staff? Were you coming as a veteran head coach who could kind of give insight to her? Were you coaching directly with the players, maybe in the post or whatever, concentrating on offense or a little bit of everything?
Well, this was the thing. I had watched Dawn build the program, and first off, Dawn was known as a defensive coach. And she was one of the teams that we'd go down to the wire, and she'd get at the end, she was getting the stop to beat us. And I feared their defense, and they took us out of everything with hard physical denial, man to man. And that was her expertise. And my expertise was offense. So I served a purpose where I came in, we made the position the director of offensive coaching analytics. And she already had 3 coaches, and they won 30 games the year before I got there. So she wasn't going to make any coaching changes. I was an additional position that her administration was willing to add for 9 months. The position was, I could do everything. I could go to every game. I could go to every practice. I could be in every coach's meeting, every film, the only thing I couldn't do was coach on the court. I could not work with the players individually or coach them on the court. So what I brought was a different set of eyes, a different perspective. And, you know, Don, I'll tell you, I think the biggest thing I did was stretch everyone on staff. You know, they saw it this way, I saw it that way. I became like an executive coach to the coaches, where I learned how to ask questions and not tell people what to do. I didn't have to have the answers. I had to help them find the answers. But I gave ideas, offenses, defenses, game planning, watched a ton of film, and I knew the league very well. So, you know, I would basically was that person on the inside that got to look at the other teams like Kentucky and go, hey, if I were planning to play you guys, this is what I would do. This is what we look like, where the assistants are worried about Kentucky and what they're doing.
Right. Right.
I got to be the opponent and tell them, you better worry. We better game plan for this, because this is what I would do to you. You know, I the first 11 games, hey, Dawn, until we play so-and-so, we're going to see a zone every game. And until our kids from the outside, all these great offenses, non-offenses, they're going to pack it in on Asia. They're going to pack it in on Alicia, all those kids, Coates, and we're going to have to be able to hit outside shots. Now, you got outside shooters on the roster, but until they prove it, there's going to be 5 kids in the paint. So we better work on offense, zone offense, you know, those types of things. They're thinking, well, I just saw 10 films on Tulane, and this is what they're going to do. Now, when they play us, this is what they're going to do. I played you guys.
Was that a fun role to have, kind of the devil's advocate consultant?
It was a lot of fun, to be honest with you. It was a lot of fun. And you know, I had free rein to speak and say things that other assistants couldn't, because I had, you know, I was in a different position for Dawn, and she respected my opinion, and I could say things, you know, about, you know, maybe we should think about doing this, maybe persuade and push some things, that, and open up the game a little more than, because she was very successful doing it the way she was doing it, but she wasn't satisfied with that. Dawn's never satisfied, and Dawn wanted to win the national championship, and she wanted to beat UConn and all those things. So I kept watching UConn, and then I would do a lot of analytics, that I wanted to learn. I could pull up stats and after the game and really break things down and text her a whole bunch of stuff that I thought was a difference in the game and what we needed to improve on just between her and I. Just a different lens.
Where's your championship ring now?
On my desk in the basement.
Awesome. What's next for you, Coach? I know we were talking about it beforehand, and maybe you don't have the answer, but what are you doing now, and what are you looking forward to?
Well, right now I'm spending time with my family. I've had a really big change in my life. Down the stretch at Vandy, I adopted two children, one from Dallas and one from Memphis. And, you know, I was running all over, trying to recruit nationally, and I felt like I needed to step back. Like I was telling you earlier, I think the name of my book is going to be Step Back. I really feel like I needed to spend more time, you know, studying the game again, getting innovative again, and I got to do that with Dawn. I didn't just give them another lens. They gave me another lens. And one of the things I got to learn from Dawn and Lisa Boyer was they had coached and played in the pros, and so I got to learn a lot of the pro ball. And so really right now, that's one of the things I'm looking into and been studying and having time to. You know, I just needed some time to grow. I've been going to clinics, learning and listening and growing. And it's been unbelievable, as well as spending more time with my children. So we put roots down in Columbus, Ohio, so we could get some family support. We've been in four cities in 4 years, and we just needed to put some roots down for the kids and figure it out when we got here.
Well, I'm sure you'll be doing great things again on the basketball court very soon, I would imagine. And Coach, thank you so much for taking the time to jump on the podcast and speak at our conference early in the summer. You've been a great inspiration to a lot of us who were there and have had the pleasure to hear you speak. And look forward to you helping us kind of bridge the gap. And from, you know, Rising Coaches has been really kind of carved out a niche for itself, especially on the men's side, and we're looking forward to helping bridge that gap onto the women's side. So I appreciate everything you've done for us.
Well, I think ball is ball, you know, and I think you're starting to see the men's NBA hire some women. I'd like it to be more across the board. We've hired a lot of men on the women's side in the last 5 years, and I'd like it to be reciprocal on the other part. I think basketball is basketball. I don't think it has anything to do with your gender when you're sitting with your staff trying to figure out the best way to put your team in a position to be and individually to be successful. So I love talking with men's coaches. I grew up, you know, my dad coached, my brother coached, Pete Carrill, I talked about, Skip Crosser, Coach Bird over at Belmont. You know, a lot of my My influences have been on the guy's side. I even, 1 year in college, I coached with my dad in boys high school and didn't play for a year. So, like, I just don't see the gender thing. You know, that's just not who I am. And I think if we can start doing more of that, I think we can just grow the game and make it even better.
I totally agree. Oh, and I wanted to share this with you. I meant to tell you this earlier, but when I was in college, I was a manager at University of Tampa, tried to walk on, quickly realized wasn't good enough. But one of our assistants was a woman, and her name was Lisa Beamer.
Yeah.
And she did a great job. But yeah, women on the men's side, and she was fantastic and taught our guys a ton. And she was a winner. At the end of the day, she was a winner. She knew the game and was tough. That was
and
great.
You know, we've been using, you know, for the last 15 years, we've been using guy players. And that's been a really good influence on us. Like, there's a lot of guy players that I still stay in touch with that are now coaching on the women's side. And they were just practice players. But they had basketball IQ and played in high school. And what they brought to the table, they made our team better every day. In fact, that's what I got to do a lot with at South Carolina. I sat with the practice guys every day. And I enjoyed that and had so much fun with that. And, you know, we just had a blast because, you know, that was an influx of something different. I think some people are opening up about it. I think it's just going to take some time and some women to be a little braver and more courageous and go for it on that side as well.
Well, Coach, thank you so much. We really appreciate it. And hopefully we'll talk to you again soon.
Thanks. I enjoyed it. Anytime.
Thanks, Melanie.
All right. Bye-bye.